I kind of broke my nose, not just against German coal unions, but also against the intransigence of Fridays for Future in Germany, where it was completely obvious that the next move would have been organizing massive disobedience themselves, and the leadership and the base both stood against that. There was a left wing in Fridays for Future, but it was not powerful enough. And there was this lovely quote, everything must change so everything can remain the same. And that's, I think, largely what Fridays would have wanted to do.
I think that those positions are in a state of flux. And you see it quite notably with Extinction Rebellion, which was so extremely committed to a very narrow definition of nonviolence in 2019, now starting to diversify into systematically smashing the windows of major banks in the UK, those banks pouring trillions of dollars and pounds into fossil fuel extractions. And that confrontation is something that our side, we progressives, can't shy away from. And when it comes to the climate, we should try to act as radically as we can without going too far and alienating people before we have those mega disasters where 20 million people are killed.
All right, guys, a warm welcome to all our listeners. Welcome to the Dissents podcast, to this week's show. And thank you for joining me and two of the leading thinkers of the radical climate movement in the global north, Tadeo Müller and Andreas Malm. I think they need no introduction. If you want to know more about them, take a look at the show notes where I link some information. This Malm-Müller debate is about what could and what should be the next steps for Fridays for Future, Extinction Rebellion, and the climate movement in general. Guys, thank you so much for joining me. Let's start with Tadeo. Is it actually the first time that you're debating these questions with Andreas?
No. In 2009, I was traveling around Europe, agitating for, well, Seattle-style disobedience at the UNFCCC summit in the climate summit in Copenhagen, 2009, the COP15. There was a, I'm going to say, fairly sort of centrist climate activist in Sweden who was extremely, extremely irritated by the fact that some of us Linksradikale mobilizing for civil disobedience, which may lead to violence. That centrist climate activist was Andreas Malm, and he then was the activist, and I was the academic. Did you remember?
Of course, in Copenhagen, yes.
And it's sort of funny how things have kind of flipped by now.
Yeah, it's quite funny what a journey you made, Andreas. So now you're proposing in your latest book on climate change, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, you're proposing disobedience on the scale of sabotage and property destruction. So maybe take us back to the old Andreas Malm and what led you to the Andreas Malm that you are now.
Well, I don't know how interesting my personal journey is, but let me just point out that I, back then, I mean, the incident Tadeo referred to, I believe happened in 2009, yes, in Copenhagen, I think, in the run-up to COP15. I engaged in very kind of gentle sabotage in 2007 in the form of defeating SUVs in Stockholm and elsewhere in Sweden, something I describe in the book. But I had, in the run-up to COP15, fairly classical Trotskyist mass line that the point should be to bring as many people as possible onto the streets and have a mass demonstration. Mm. And we should focus all our efforts on drawing in as large parts of the population as possible into this thing. And we organized a demonstration that was, until then, I think, the largest climate demonstration that had occurred in the global north, at least, with around 100,000 people on the streets. And that gave absolutely no positive result. It yielded less than zero because the outcomes, of course, of that summit were so disastrous. And I was very far from the only one who came home from Copenhagen with a sense that the climate movement needs to do something completely different. And of course, what then developed was much more in line with what Tadeo and his comrades were suggesting in those debates. And I'm very happy to admit that I was on the wrong side in those debates.
Okay, guys, I guess this personal episode and how it panned out is actually telling us something about where we are right now in our struggle against global heating. But let's leave personal matters aside and talk strategy, guys. Simple question. What should the climate movement do from here on out?
How about we tell the story a little bit historically, because then we also come to that keeps us on the question of strategy. Maybe we go back for a second.
Yeah.
In the North, you had the Global Justice Movement, also known as the Alter Globalization Movement. Now, the strategy of that movement, or what the NGOs unfortunately call theory of change nowadays, was that we as movements cannot really achieve global effects. As social movements, we are too weak. But if the other side, as it were, achieves effects at the global scale through generating institutional processes, WTO, et cetera, and so forth, then we can piggyback on their globality defined as the ability to have global effects. And by protesting at the global summits, we can have global effects. That was sort of the idea of the alter-globalization movement. And in fact, the climate justice movement, as sort of seen from the perspective of the Copenhagen summit, which came 10 years after Seattle, was in a way another iteration of the global justice movement. And I think there were folks like Andreas who've been thinking about climate change for a long time, but many of us global justice leftists only came to the issue in 2007 around the Heiligendamm G8 summit. And the idea behind Copenhagen, the mobilization, and I think that was the idea of moderates and radicals, was that you somehow put a lot of pressure on the UNFCCC and that they will then not engage in these stupid market-based regulations, but something better, undefined better. And obviously that completely failed because there is no global climate policy. It's a complete mirage. And now I would like to ask Andreas, how would you frame... So basically Copenhagen was a disaster for kind of everybody. The governments had a total disaster. The demonstration was huge, but it was so nice and friendly. It was like, could you guys do something about climate change, please? Yeah, all right, cool. And the direct actions were brutally repressed, were tactical flops. There were 2,000 people arrested without cause, preemptively, treated really badly, and everybody failed.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Andreas, you said there was a shift in the movements after that. How would you express that?
Well, I completely agree with your history of the climate movement here. My account of this shift would be that COP15, the summit in Copenhagen, ended the illusion that we could, as you say, push the UN to implement the necessary measures. And it prompted the climate movement to start targeting fossil fuel production head on. In the US, this took the form of the divestment movement, the campaign against the Keystone XL pipeline, later the Dakota Access pipeline, and of course the various indigenous struggles against pipelines in the US and Canada as well. In Europe, the great innovation, the great strategic innovation was, in my view, Ende Gelände, which really gave new life to the climate movement in Europe.
If I can just, I'll play this card only once, since you're the one who's currently writing academic books.
Yeah.
Professor Malm, could you not, Professor, explain Ende Gelände to one of its key organizers?
Of course. Of course.
No, yeah, this is from my view, but you can go and correct me. But my understanding of it and my greatest praise is reserved for people like yourself, who actually built this movement, because it's the best movement that we've had in Europe, as far as I can say. But this is just my understanding of the phase that ended with COP15 and the phase that began after it.
We're very much in line. So there were some anarchists who even stood to the left of us, Reclaim the Power in Copenhagen, who said we have to hit the production. That was their slogan.
Yeah.
And it's, of course, true. If there's no political regulation that you can influence that makes any difference, and obviously we know that global climate policy makes no difference at all. It is probably the only policy field that doesn't affect the climate one way or the other. So you have to go and, as it were, hit the production. But what happened? The British climate movement was the strongest in the second half of the noughts. But then they had the financial crisis and the British climate camp wrote its famous transformation or metamorphosis statement, basically saying we're going to dissolve ourselves into the anti-austerity protests. So that meant that the baton passed to Germany in the climate movement, at least in Europe. So the climate camp, the first in the west of Germany was started in 2010, the first in the east in 2011. They did sort of small scale actions against the point of production. Their problems, however, were twofold. First, they were tiny actions. There was nobody there. There were a few hundred people. And secondly, they started encountering workers' resistance, not explicit or very strong. And so the strategy of going to hit the production was, first of all, as a sort of matter of, we're going to use our bodies to shut down emissions. So a non-mediated direct action strategy failed between 2010 and 2014 because we didn't even get more than 500, 600, 700 people to an action. And Ende Gelände was actually an attempt to bring sort of tactics from other movements, from the anti-nuclear movement and others, to that, and make these actions actually spectacular and symbolic actions. This is what I want to get to. I'm going to use a term. What's our strategy or theory of change? How do we think that the protests or actions we organize will actually reach the effect that we want them to have? And that's what I'd really like to talk about. How? So I can explain to you the theory of change that Ende Gelände worked with, partly because I co-wrote it, but also because a lot of people, myself included, would like to want to know how the ideas that Andreas develops in How to Blow Up a Pipeline, because they seem to me mostly tactical ideas. And I'm not saying this as sort of, let's have a big row about it, but let's try and understand each other, because I am no longer very hopeful that we can come up with realistic strategies that bridge the gap between what is necessary and what is possible.
So Andreas, are you more hopeful in this regard than Tacho is? And tell us about the strategies and tactics you propose in How to Blow Up a Pipeline, one of your recent books.
Well, I think that it's some years ago since hope about climate was an emotional fuel. I don't think that I or anyone else am powered by an exhilarating sense of the great hope we have about the state of the climate and what great progress we're making. Well, maybe Joe Biden and Elon Musk and Bill Gates have those feelings, but I don't count them really belonging to our camp. So the argument I make in How to Blow Up a Pipeline for an escalation in our tactics and for considering things like property destruction in various forms is based precisely on the realization that we haven't come anywhere near making the difference that we need to make. And I'm not suggesting that it is likely that we will win this struggle, however that's defined, but I'm making the case that you cannot base your politics on probability assessments. And if the likelihood of defeat is overwhelming, that doesn't make it any more exigent to fight. To the contrary, the odds can be so bad that it's precisely therefore that you have to fight. Mm. And I think the fact that we have essentially failed in the climate movement so far, and as Tadjo has eloquently argued in several contexts, we have failed in even making a dent in the aggregate global emissions curves. We have failed mostly in local national battles as well. There are local victories here and there, but nothing on the scale of what we need. But all of this is just a guarantee that we will have more confrontations and more struggles in the years ahead. Not only about the emissions themselves, but about adaptation, about geoengineering, about negative emissions. And there will be an explosion, a proliferation of political conflicts around climate, precisely because the situation is so bad. And that means that it's more important than ever to try to intervene in those various fields, because we can't just let the enemy in its various guises decide about what forms of adaptation, what forms of negative emissions, what forms of geoengineering we should have, not to leave out the central question of how emissions themselves are going to develop.
Could you elaborate a bit, Andreas, what kind of radicalization you think about that you put forward in your book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline? What kind of direct action are you talking about?
Yeah, so you can approach this question from different perspectives. But one thing that really stood out in 2019, and this book was a product of the conjuncture of 2019, was that we had a lot of social movement mobilization happening around the world in that year. And the climate movement was the exception to the rule of combative and confrontational tactics in Chile, in Lebanon, in Hong Kong. Wherever there was social protest in 2019, it included property destruction and confrontation with the cops. The climate movement was the only one that stayed to exclusively peaceful mass protest and civil disobedience with nothing in along the lines of even property destruction. And I think that contrast is quite remarkable, and it is not in correspondence with the viciousness of fossil capital and with the magnitude of the problem of the climate crisis. So what the climate movement needs to do, in my view, is to catch up with some of the other social movements that have been developing recently, including in the global north, not the least the glorious uprising after the murder of George Floyd. That is a kind of model for how we can mobilize in the global north, in my view. Mm.
Okay, let me jump in there, because those are some very, very interesting points. And it is certainly the case that the climate movement has been, in the global north, dominated by, I mean, there was a sort of normative nonviolence approach pushed very much by the early incarnation of XR, which was extremely annoying. Yeah. Not XR, the normative nonviolence approach. Ende Gelände always had a tactical nonviolence approach, as in we're being nonviolent because that is what in the current conjuncture here in Germany seems for us to generate the most effects. Now, and there's the examples that you used, and these are not like gotcha questions. I'm not trying to say, oh my God, you're so wrong, but say, I see what you're saying. However, the examples, Chile, Lebanon, and Hong Kong, and Black Lives Matter, all refer to people fighting, well, for their lives sounds a bit pathos heavy, but like, I'm not currently fighting for my life in Germany. Most climate activists in Germany are not fighting for their lives or their social and cultural existences. So they must be taken into account. It's easier to mobilize with a more militant tactic when there is a sense that folks' existence is on the line. Mm. And that sense doesn't yet exist in large parts of the global north. So it seems to me that while I have absolutely no problem with endorsing all manners of sabotage, and of course, Andreas also draws the line at, but draws a distinction between infrastructure and people, yeah, human bodies, as it were. And that's very important. I didn't mean to say that in any way ironic. That's an extremely, important distinction. But the thing is, we need to put the tactic into the context of a strategy, and we need to discuss how that strategy refers to broader social forces. Because, and I'm now going to make a bit of a jump, later on, surely in the debate, we're going to end up with this question of the state. What do we think the state is going to do? So one of my favorite state theorists said that the state is the material condensation of social force relations. The material condensation of social force relations. That's to say, force relations between social groups. We need to work out who in the global north, which is where your book is largely aimed at, Andreas, and where most of my organizing has taken place, who in the global north actually has the interest and the capacity to stop the climate crisis? Because that was the move that the young Marx made with the industrial proletariat. I mean, he was obviously terribly wrong, but it was still an interesting intellectual exercise. He said, in the expropriation of the new industrial proletariat, I see everybody's expropriation. So there's an interest, but they also have the capability because they're sitting right at the point of production. Now, again, whether that was right or wrong is not the point, but it was the right question. And it seems to me that as a climate activist in Germany, we've always struggled with the fact that we actually went against most people's material interest. Mm. That's a question that isn't answered by giving an excellent and coherent justification of a tactical escalation.
Let me just say that there are so many problems at stake here. And I have to say that I feel a privilege to discuss them with Tanja, because I don't know any other interlocutor that have more insight into this, yeah, deserve to be out there. And I've been trying to convince Tanja to put them to paper so that we can read them in the English language and in book form or something else. Because I think all your experiences and insights from the struggle in Germany over the past decade and more would deserve that, and it would be of great use. But let's leave the question of the subject and Marx and the state to the side for the moment, and just stay with the question of the contrast and whether the reason that people don't fight as militantly for climate justice in the global north has to do with whether their lives are at stake or not. And let's stay with that. Let me just preface this by saying that I'm totally aware of the difference between the kind of principled, in my view, slightly dogmatic pacifism propounded by XR in its 2019 edition, and the tactical nonviolence used by Ende Gelände, which clearly is framed in another way. And I think that Ende Gelände has, of course, done exactly the right thing in asking the question, what tactics are most useful for us in the concrete political situation we find ourselves in this country? And that's always the question that should be asked about those things. You should never deploy tactics for dogmatic, universal reasons, but only if and when they can actually work on the ground. That in itself is a deviation from any kind of dogma about tactics. That's where I think XR made a huge mistake in its ideas in 2019. Now, the question of life and death. Yes, some of the struggles that I alluded to in 2019 and in 2020 as well are obviously about direct physical existence, notably the Floyd uprising, where it was a matter of a man getting killed in a way that far too many African Americans have endured for a very long time. And people immediately saw that this is a question of life and death, and therefore they were ready to go out and confront the cops and destroy certain kinds of property and things like that. When it comes to the climate crisis, that sense, yes, you're right, is still largely lacking in much of the global north. I do believe that there are instances, even in the global north, when a case could be made to people that your lives are at stake. And one country where this has been quite conspicuously the case recently is Australia, where people have suffered some quite serious losses from wildfires back in 2019 to 20, and more recently floods in the very same parts of that country. And my reading from a distance is that there is quite a lot of distress and even anger about those losses, and that people are quite fearful for their lives. The problem is that this doesn't translate into attacks on the sources of the misery, with Australia still being the world's largest coal exporter and having a government that is banking on even further expansion of coal and gas. Now, as I've tried to suggest in a number of contexts after my book came out, if hypothetically in the next moment of extreme climate disaster in Australia, and it will come, we know that for a certainty, some groups of activists were to call for a demonstration or some other kind of action against a coal installation and go in and wreck it, destroy it in one way or another, I think that could be very useful for people in Australia to get out of their paralysis and despair and open the realization that unless we do something about coal extraction to begin with, as we have in this country, we're doomed to burning ourselves and drowning ourselves to death. And I think the perception of whether life or death is at stake is something that is made or not. And the task of the climate movement in these situations is to bring home the message that, yes, your life is at stake. And it doesn't have to be your life. It can be the life of multitudes elsewhere. And we know that climate disasters will kill millions of people in the years and decades ahead. And that's when the climate movement has the task to demonstrate to people and tell people that fossil fuel technologies are a source of those people's death. And that death is mediated through the atmosphere, unlike the death that was inflicted on George Floyd. But it is death nonetheless. It is murder. It is killing. It is violence. And it should be treated as such. And our task is to show this to people in word and in deed.
I agree with you, but there were a number of sleight of hands in there. Like, for example, it is either their lives, comma, or the lives of multitudes elsewhere. Now, you are saying this in a supremely racist world where multitudes whose skin color is different. And by the way, I'm not one of those critics who suggests that you're not aware of racism. With the Zetkin Collective, I think you wrote the...
White skin, black few.
Exactly. So I'm not saying that you're not aware of that. But it seems to me that you're ignoring a little bit how that structures people's interests. Because of course I can convince people that their lives are at stake in some distant future. To say that multitudes elsewhere are threatened. I mean, I live in Germany. During the Euro crisis, people in Germany started realizing that our wealth is the precondition for, say, the Greeks' poverty. Did people give a fuck? No. Material interest is constructed relatively. And the global north is essentially, in that sense, a sort of global labor aristocracy.
Yeah.
The interests, the material interests of the vast majority of people in the global north are such that they support the continued destruction of the biosphere in terms of their short to medium term material interests. And I do not say this as a matter of moral criticism. I say this as a matter of fact. And it seems to me a little bit that, Andreas, what you're saying is something what climate movements have been doing for several years. I mean, Tetet Lauron, my good friend from the Philippines, she was at a Friday's demo in Aachen in 2019. And she said that, I think her words were along the lines of, my kids told me to tell you to kind of stop destroying their world or their homes. But Fridays didn't respond to that with a mass wave of civil disobedience, though some of us were agitating towards that. In fact, Fridays for Future, I think in the end went with its interest as northern middle-class activists for whom the maintenance of the status quo is a better bet than the destruction of the status quo. Yeah. And that's where we come back to the global north versus global south. If you live in relative material comfort, then the pitch, hey, let's just fuck this shit up and see what happens afterwards, which is, of course, what we as lefty radicals really are comfortable with, for most people is not a good pitch. is not a good sales pitch. And I say this as somebody who's not just a strategist, but also a public relations guy. So I'm a salesman, essentially.
Sure. There's a contradiction in your argument, though, and that's that on the one hand, you give up on change coming from within the global north because it's a labor aristocracy. On the other hand, you want a message that can convince people in the global north to jump on board. If you go with the line that the global north is essentially a labor aristocracy and that people in Germany are beholden to business as usual and there's no way we convince them, then the implication of that would to me be a strategy somewhat along the lines of the Blekingegarde band or something like that, that all your actions inside the imperialist core should be designed so as to support people in the global south, and our political mandate as climate activists in the global north stems from what people in the Philippines have to go through. And that to me,
Let me just finish.
I'm not rejecting that argument. I'm just saying that the political implication of that argument
should be
radicalization and escalation of the tactics.
Andreas, now we're doing exactly what male academics tend to do, with shouting at each other. Now, first of all, I do not refer to the Blekingegarden gang, which is something that we need to maybe explain to the listeners.
Yeah, you should.
As a kind of urban guerrilla, an urban third worldist guerrilla, like the Weatherman, Action Direct, Brigade Rosse, RAF, Blekingegarden. Now, my position, I'm going to go back to my own story. Now, Ende Gelände in 2015 managed to kind of revolutionized climate activism. We made it super sexy. We actually were tactically effective. We created a massive sense of empowerment amongst the people who took part, a sense of empowerment that Andreas describes extremely eloquently, although parenthetically, he was part of the March of Fools, as we in the Ende Gelände Command Center called it, which massively fucked with our PR strategy, but I understand why you did it. I would have done it as well if I'd been in your finger, as it were. Now, from 2015 onwards, the German anti-coal movement essentially went on a power play. Until 2018, we played every move out of the strategic rule book that we took from the anti-nuclear movement. We played every move at its best. Ende Gelände was sort of the best example of event-based activism we've seen in a long time. At the same time, we had the comrades in Hambacher Wald creating the kind of stable place occupation where you can, on the one hand, generate sort of media activity, but especially you can also train cadre. So you had that sort of perfect, you had events and places, and you had an opponent, Fossil Capital, which was really behaving incredibly stupidly. I mean, when RWE said in the middle of 2018, we're going to cut down Humber Forest, I was angry for 3 seconds and then extremely excited for 3 hours because I thought, wow, great. They're giving us exactly what we need. We even defended Hambach Forest. We managed to convince 75% of the German population of an early coal phase out around 2030. Even half of the AfD voters, fascist party, were in favor of that. But still, the political system, driven by a coalition of coal unions, coal companies, and coal regions, managed to beat us back. We got a coal phase out in 2038, which is ludicrous. Mm. So at this point, the strategy of small groups, say, but in the lower thousands or low tens of thousands of highly trained activist cadre doing actions, those actions creating media attention, that media attention shifting public opinion, and then some sort of political crisis like, say, Fukushima happens where the government is forced to act in the way the movement wants. That's the theory of change, that strategy that we inherited from the anti-nuclear movement. Yeah, okay. The problem was that the other side was too effective in the backyard, in the corridors of political power, where movements are very far away and very weak. So at that point, when the Kohl Commission in Germany gave out its report 2038, I fell into a political depression until I saw Fridays 2 months later. Fridays for Future are a generational actor. In a way, you could do with Fridays for Future the same thing that young Marx did with industrial proletariat. Say, in the theft of this generation's future is contained the theft of all of our future. And given that material interest is constructed relatively, a generationally constituted actor, actually even in the global north has a material interest for fighting for some sort of climate policy or some climate reform at least. Because, again, it's relatively constructed, not as a generational actor, it would be constructed vis-a-vis folks in the south, but vis-a-vis older generations. Also, Marxism and the left aren't good with understanding generational processes. 1968 was very much a generational revolt. And I think we need to look at the possibility of a global generational revolt and what stands in the way of that. I'm not talking about small-scale urban guerrillas. What I'm talking about is hundreds of thousands of people engaging in Ende Gelände-style disobedience and not a few hundreds.
Sorry, guys, I have to jump in here and give our listeners some perspective before you reply, Andreas. At this point, I'd like to mention that Tatsu is trying not to force, but...
promote!
Yeah, he was lobbying Fridays for Future to take up civil disobedience and the Gelände-style tactics, sort of scaling up more militant tactics. And so far, he was not able to convince Fridays for Future's leadership. They refused to engage in that escalation on the grounds that they think it will alienate people and the climate movement will lose respect and support. And to some extent, I see that point. If I think about smashing windows of fossil fuel exporters right now, destroying pipelines, stuff like that, at this moment at least, see the notions of eco-terrorism popping up and dominating public discourse, actually. So, Andreas, what do you think about those two issues?
Yeah, I'll comment on what you said, Lucas, and then I want to comment on what Tadjo said. I think that those positions are in a state of flux. And you see it quite notably with Extinction Rebellion, which was so extremely committed to a very narrow definition of nonviolence in 2019, now starting to diversify into systematically smashing the windows of major banks in the UK, those banks pouring trillions of dollars and pounds into fossil fuel extraction. So you can see those videos from recent weeks where XR activists go up to the windows of Barclays and HSBC and banks like that and shattering their windows. Mm. And I think that you will see processes of radicalization coming out of the Greta Thunberg generation as well, when those kids realize that business as usual still hasn't been tinkered with, let alone terminated. And when you see more climate disaster strike, I think that position that you outlined as the one taken in response to Tanju will start to crack, at least among some of the young cadres of the Fridays for Future movement. Now, but I want to go back to what Tadjo said, because I think Tadjo is getting at something really, really important here. First of all, my reference to Blekingegadeligaen, the Blekingegadeband, was not to suggest that your line of argumentation would end up with armed robberies of banks, but what they suggested was that the working class in the global north is not in a position to oppose the imperialist world order, because the material interests of the working class are in line with the capitalist classes, and therefore everything we do in the global north will have to be on the mandate of national liberation movements in the global south. And there's an affinity with that logic and the logic of some of what you've said, Tadjo. And I'm not saying that the logic is necessarily wrong empirically, because I actually think that you're quite right, in particular, about some of the trade unions in Germany. And here's where I have a problem with quite a few of my Trotskyist comrades who are upset with what I've written, because I don't put any emphasis on trade union struggles. And some of them argue that what I suggest would immediately alienate the trade unions. And still, what's important, if we're going to make any headway in the climate struggle, they argue, is to win over the trade unions. That's kind of the default Trotskyist argumentation. And I see some point in that too. But it's very hard for me to see how trade unions in the global north can articulate a material interest that leads workers into climate consciousness. Mm. Instead, what Tadjo is arguing in his latest intervention here is that the other subject that we have in the global north that can potentially be a subject for change is the youth, and that it's based on age, and that is the foundation for the movement that we saw in 2019. And I think there is some truth in this. And I think when we think about the formation of a climate subject in the global north, I think we can see three things that can propel people into forming such a subject. One being knowledge about the crisis, and that knowledge doesn't have to be based on having any kind of academic credentials or anything. It can be a very basic knowledge, so basic that even kids at a very young age could have that knowledge. Or it could be the experience of climate harm or alarm, or it could be, third, solidarity with people in the global south. And I think you saw all those three factors at work in the movement in 2019. And I think these factors will intensify in the coming years, including the experience of actual harm from climate disasters. We saw that in 2018, and that was a very important factor in triggering the mobilization in 2019. The extreme heat, the droughts, the wildfires really made people quite scared. And even in affluent countries like Sweden and Germany, I think, in the summer of 2018, that will happen again. We don't know if it will happen this summer, but it's coming again, or in different forms. And you will have, hopefully, but this is a matter of movement mobilization and tactics and ideology production, hopefully you will have solidarity with people in the global south when they suffer even worse disasters. These are some foundations for founding a climate subject in the global north, not necessarily the point of interest at the point of production in the workplace, which is the one that Trotskyists such as myself normally by default refer to. But it's very, very hard to see how coal workers in Lausitz, or for that matter, car workers in Sweden, would from their workplace position express their material interests in a way that translates into climate consciousness. So yes, the subject needs to be formed somewhere else.
It's not just hard to see, Andreas. Let's not, I mean, I appreciate that you're so self-critical of the Trotskyist tradition, which in this regard really plays a very irritating role, I have to say. But it's not so much difficult to see, but it's basically a realistic strategic analysis, also based on the experiences we've had in Germany and elsewhere, shows that the trade unions express, and this is by the way another Trotskyist canard, that the trade union leadership is sort of reactionary and the workers at the base are all these super progressive radicals. Oh my God, have you actually talked to factory workers?
Yeah.
And the coal workers stood, they say in German, wie eine Eins, they stood solidly behind their union and its radical anti-climate position. IG Metall, which is the German, well, the German car union, essentially. It's the corporatist union that organizes Germany's largest sector. I mean, they are part and parcel of the capital relation. Let's spend a few minutes on knocking out that workers thing out of the ballpark, because I'm so bored by it. I mean, I worked at the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, and honestly, they made me waste so much time saying, oh, you have to talk to coal workers. I'm like, I talked to coal workers. Their interests are not up to our construction. Like, it's not, I'm going to go there. By the way, comrade, do you know what you have? You've got a false consciousness. Like, what the fuck? No, seriously, it is very clear that their immediate material interest is against us shutting down their jobs. And the same with the car unions. They're already articulating a position where they're saying, well, the only way we can do climate is to build loads more electric cars. So basically, we're getting into a problem of productivism, and essentially workers in the global north want to produce more because more production means more jobs. Now, I am, I think, unlike Andreas, a degrowther, so that might be an interesting issue to talk about. But from an ecological perspective, the problem with capitalism is not the struggle between capital and labor, or that capital is so mean to labor. From an ecological perspective, the problem of capitalism is that it's so expansive. It needs to constantly take new parts of the world into its space of accumulation and thus destroy them. And the capital relation consists of capital plus labor. So you have to be a crazy dogmatic Marxist to say we can somehow convince these workers whose objective fucking interest is in producing more stuff so that they can continue working because they're doubly free and therefore need a job to survive. Could we just start saying almost certainly industrial workers in the global north will not just not be our allies, they will be our enemies, and they'll be our most effective enemies, because unlike fossil capital, fossil fuel workers are actual people and can't just reinvest themselves into a hedge fund in Chile. So I'd really like to know your position on this, Andreas, because I have spoken to so many people on the left who can't get over this thing. It's got to be the workers. Like, no, that is just wrong.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I do disagree with some of this. I don't think that organized labor in the global north, in countries like Germany or Sweden or the US, if there's any organized labor left in that country, will be in any way the driver or the prime mover of a climate movement, which some people seem to think. But I don't think that they are our enemies, because I don't think that coal workers are necessarily wedded to working in a coal mine. There is a recent example of this happening in the US, where one of the coal miners' unions agreed with the climate reformist who is now occupying the White House, Joe Biden, that yes, we're happy to desist from coal mining if we are guaranteed other kinds of jobs. The enemy here is the kind of capital that makes profit from fossil fuel production, because that capital in itself cannot be reinvented. The process of accumulating capital through fossil fuel production cannot be transferred to renewable energies. What I mean by this is that if you have an oil platform, you can't turn that oil platform into a centralized solar power plant or a wind turbine or something else. A lignite mine, the money that is invested into a lignite coal mine is invested into producing coal, and a coal mine cannot become a renewable energy plant or something like that. So the capital that is embodied in fossil fuel production, that is our enemy. But the workers themselves, precisely because they are people, as you said, don't have that identical interest in that particular work that they're doing. They might very well find other more fruitful work, more stimulating work in other fields. And I think the point that we shouldn't lose in the Green New Deal and similar projects is to make our interest compatible with workers and make them potential allies, not the drivers of the climate struggle, but on our side.
Sorry, but that is the same twaddle I've been hearing. Sorry to, I'm not insulting you, I'm insulting my ex-bosses at the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. Yeah. I hope they're listening to this. That is the same time-wasting crap I've spent years on in Germany. You say the workers aren't necessarily our opponents. I don't care at some level of abstraction whether they may or may not at some point in another universe maybe our opponents. The coal union was the single most effective player in Germany in shutting down the coal movements for a rapid coal phase out. Fact.
Yes, I agree.
Also, they said, sure, we'll stop working coal if you can offer us other jobs. Now, I have done a lot of reading on the subject of just transition. Just transition, a term that comes from North American trade unions from the 80s and 90s, where you had the first struggles between environmentalists and labor. And they said, oh, just transition is one where everybody is happy. The environment, and the workers, and folks from the global south, the only ones who might be unhappy are like the 0.1% or something like that. Now, it's sort of, I call this a left-wing Pareto optimum, where redistribution is sort of, okay, if only if the 1% suffer. Now, the thing is, the large fossil fuel infrastructures are almost all industrial monocultures. You will no doubt agree, Andreas, you literally wrote the book on fossil capital. And since you said such nice things about me before, I'd say, I actually don't have climate debates anymore. I really largely have lots of gay BDSM sex and work as a sex worker and find that a much more interesting thing to talk about currently than the climate. But Andreas is a sort of single-handedly, as I said, a saved Marxism from irrelevance in the climate crisis with powerful writing that addresses concerns of actual activists that resonates with the sense of urgency that drives this movement. And we're currently having a debate that over the last years has helped the German climate movement back a lot because we basically invested energy into moving people, like coal workers, from the active opponent category in the Alinsky spectrum of allies to sort of allies, which is impossible. It's impossible. You can't move people from active opponents to allies in a short time. Back to why that's the case. So having written the book on fossil capital, you know that fossil fuel infrastructures are largely industrial monocultures. Mm-hmm. Now, and you have to imagine industrial monocultures a bit like agricultural monocultures. If you take a field, you screw it for 40 years with industrial agriculture, monocropping, and pesticides, et cetera, and so forth, you're not going to get a permaculture garden the year after you shut that down. Mm. And there is not an example in the world where a large, dirty industrial sector was shut down in such a way that was considered just by the workers, mm-hmm. in such a way that they didn't fight against its closure. Now, I'm not saying this in any way, in a normative way. I'm just saying there is not a single empirical example, not even the Chinese government that, based on its authoritarianism, probably has a fairly high degree of control over its workers, was able to reduce steel production very easily. Because you can't just shut shit down in an industrial monoculture sector and then hope something new grows there. The fields will lie fallow for several years. Every ex-industrial region is a poor region. Northern England, the Rust Belt, the industrial parts of Eastern Germany. If you have a dirty industrial monoculture, first of all, it's going to be a poor area. So the workers, if you say they're going to stop working in coal if there are other jobs, I understand the position, but it's also a ploy. The unions know that there is no alternative. They've been fighting against alternatives in those regions for 30 years at the very least. So just, we're doing the same thing that has sort of driven me out of the climate. We are wasting time on questions that have empirically been answered. And in the minds of intellectuals are probably easier to sort of jump over. But there is simply no alternative that we can offer folks in Lusatia, one of the East German coal region, or the Rhineland. There is no alternative. They will fight us. And somebody explained to me how we change the German car sector at current levels of productivity, because that would mean no job losses, to something better. Like, there is no way. And the question isn't an abstract one, but a concrete one.
Mm-hmm. let me say that to suck each other's dicks in a metaphorical fashion for another moment. let me say.
Oh, I so look forward to the non-metaphorical dick sucking that will happen in about an hour or so.
I hope you excuse the metaphor. I mean, I think this is one of the things that are so valuable with your experience that it needs to be brought out, because it would, if not poke a hole, at least create some doubt in much of the global discourse around Green New Deal and all these things, that this actual struggle with the unions that you've had in Germany needs to be brought to a wider audience, because there is still a lot of illusion around how these things can work out. Now, having said that, if I were a committed Swedish social democrat, I would point to the example of the policies that were in place in this country in the 50s and 60s, where you had very rapid industrial technological development shaking out one sector after another. But you had a social democratic state that quite smoothly managed to move a part of the workforce from those industries that were shaken out to others that were on the rise through re-education, retraining, and geographical redistribution in a more or less planned manner. Now, I am not that very committed Swedish social democrat, so I'm not going to point to the
tack so much.
But I'm not sure that the situation is entirely as bleak as you suggest. But I think you're right on one very central strategic point, and that is that the climate movement really will waste time if it designs and tailors its methods and tactics and interventions exclusively to win over the trade unions. That's a kind of mirage that serves as a distraction of for the movement. And it's a very, very important point that you're making there. But I'm not entirely prepared on giving up on the idea that there can be some compatibility between a climate transition and working class material interests, even in the global north. That's as much of a Trotskyist as I'm still at.
Okay, I gotta say that at least so far, I have not given up on the working class in the global north, at least to be an ally. But Tachi, before you reply to Andreas, Andreas, like to describe where you see possible points of intervention where we can align the interests of workers in the global north with the climate justice movement. I think, for example, of labor time reduction or the conversion of certain fossil fuel heavy industries.
Yeah, we can look at the dirtiest sectors of all, such as oil production. Now, I have argued that a central demand in every country where oil companies are privately owned would be for their immediate nationalization. But those entities do not have to be liquidated physically, because in the oil companies, there are the chemical and engineering and technical skills that we need to start draw CO2 down from the atmosphere through direct air capture. Now, this opens onto another venue of debate, namely our views of negative emissions technologies, and in this case, more particularly, direct air capture. But I think that one of the advantages of that idea is that you can keep employees of nationalized Total, nationalized Shell, nationalized ExxonMobil in employment. You just set them to work on something that they are technically capable of doing, namely draw CO2 down and pump it down into the ground and reverse the accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere. When it comes to the auto industry, I do think, and here I'm in alignment with my comrades in the Fourth International in Sweden who work in the auto industry, that you can imagine converting the production of cars into something else. I mean, the auto industry is an incredibly versatile technical apparatus that could just as well produce DAC machines or solar panels or something else. That hasn't happened yet. I know. And the union caterers that have proposed it have come nowhere so far. But we have a lot of political projects that have failed. I mean, the Palestinian freedom struggle has been a failure for a century. That doesn't mean that we should give up on it, and so on and so forth.
There's a few differences. First of all, conversion is another one of those terms that has no empirical referent at all. There is no example.
Well, there is.
Of the kind that would lead to workers in these sectors to not fight against that conversion. These are all just, they're empty signifiers around which the unions can manage to convince us, the industrial unions, that they are not our enemy, while at the same time lying in bed in really awfully submissive ways, and I say this as a submissive, with the car industry. I mean, my submission is much more stylish than that of the trade unions. They're basically, with their right hand, they're working with the car industry to expand production, and they send their left hand, the one guy or girl who knows about conversion, to speak to us climate activists. Yeah. I mean, I have basically been screwed over in ways that I don't appreciate by the trade unions way too often. Also, I'm way too impatient. And given that there's not that much time to do these processes, also, we're going to have to talk a bit about the corona demobilization. Because obviously in 2020, it would have been the point when Fridays for Future would have had to fight back against the inaction of the German government. Yeah. And then, of course, nobody could fight back. But essentially, the idea that, say, the German car industry, which makes its money from overproducing illegally dirty, hyper-large cars.
Yeah.
The idea that that can be turned into some sort of socially useful industry where you would have to massively reduce the level of production, that would mean you'd have to either redistribute work or let people go. So again, all the things you're saying, Andreas, they've all been said for about 10 years. We've tried all of these things, and it turns out that they didn't work. People, for example, I mean, think in the corona lockdown, do you think it's really attractive for people to say, hey, you can have more time? For folks in the industrial sectors, work remains not just their primary source of income, but also of identity, of social connections, of, how do you say, soziale Teilhabe, participating in society. Now, we can talk to them about conversion projects until the cows come home. All the while, the trade union leadership plots with the leadership of capital how to produce more German SUVs. This is not an abstract question. Empirically, what you're saying isn't happening. Now, of course, you can say it may happen, but as a strategist, I'd have to figure out how it can happen, and I don't see a path towards that.
No, I agree with much of what you're saying, but the first thing you said, I disagree with, and that was that none of these conversions have ever happened. I mean, parts of the auto industry in Sweden and in the US during this pandemic did convert into producing material for the hospital sector in treating the victims of the pandemic. And of course, that was much smaller than the enormous conversion of the auto sector in the US to fight the Second World War. And all this happened without the workers protesting. In fact, I believe quite a few workers in those factories were quite happy with the conversion that happened during COVID-19. But yes, you're right. Again, I stress this. We cannot, given the awful state of the labor movement in our countries, adapt our strategies to the single focus of winning them over. We just have to keep that as part of the transition, that once it gets underway, if it ever does, the workers will have to be on board, not our enemies. Now, we need to recognize, I think, here also that the generally dismal state of class struggle in our part of the world, in our moment in history, is a major obstacle to any progress on the climate front. If we would have had the 1970s as the time when we had to deal with acute climate catastrophe, the parameters would have been very different. That was when the working class was at its peak of political and economic strength in our part of the world. And that also opened the working class, at least it's more advanced, caters to questions around quality of life, quality of labor, reduced labor time, and all of these things that are now so incredibly difficult to talk about because the working class is a decomposed social political force that is fragmented, that is completely under the control of its bureaucracy, and that is fighting to maintain its material interests, which still include, we should of course acknowledge, and that's the labor aristocracy component, quite a few material privileges. And the combination of this means that the working class in our countries today isn't necessarily that emancipatory force that we would like it to be on the climate front. And we really should get away from that traditional illusion about the working class without, I hope, giving up completely.
Okay, guys, let's move on. We agree that workers will not be the driving force in the struggle against global heating. The question remains whether we can win them over as allies or not. Sure. Okay. But where do we go from here?
Okay, so the workers will not lead the struggle. They may be opponents or they may be passive. We couldn't decide. Small groups of activist, highly specialized cadre, by small groups, I mean in the thousands or low tens of thousands, trying to shift public opinion in such a way that then the political system responds. At least the most powerful European climate movement, the German one, failed with that strategy. Which takes us back, I think, to the generational actor.
Yeah.
You mentioned various struggles at the beginning of this conversation, Andreas, in terms of their tactics. Now, if you draw, you've got tactics, strategy, and the base. I would start from the base, strategy, and then tactics. Who were the base of most of the large progressive struggles in the last years? And it's not, by the way, it's not about age, it's about events in the Badiou sense. It's the financial crisis shaped a generation, not because people are now 13 years old, but because that's one of the things that happened that shaped their identities. I really recommend a book by Keir Milburn, Generation Left. Amazing. Now, Chile was the generación sin miedo, the generation without fear. Those were the people who didn't have relatives thrown out of Pinochet's helicopters. And Black Lives Matter, although it is careful to point out that it is not a youth-based movement or youth-led movement, partly because African-American communities have strong notions of elder leadership, is nonetheless empirically very much a young people-led movement. The Bernie Sanders movement, young people, the climate movement, young people. In fact, it isn't workers or small groups of radical activists. It is, I venture, largely generationally constituted actors that are leading the largest progressive struggles in the world right now. And I'd like to just stop for a moment, and I want to hear Andreas' point. Do you believe that my contention here is correct or not? And how do you relate to that?
No, I think it's correct. But I wonder how much of a historical novelty this is. Because I think you could make this argument to virtually any historical episode of social struggles, because it tends to be young people who go out and fight. I mean, the Bolshevik Revolution or any revolution, it's young people. That happened in 1968. It happened in Palestine in 87. Anywhere you go, it's young people who struggle.
But see, but that is exactly interesting.
Yeah.
It is basically like, we're Marxists, you and I. So we're like, okay, so we've got this crazy sort of intense theorization of workers and their struggles and their interests and where they live and their milieus and da-da-da-da. You and I know fuck all about generations, I'm going to say. I read this book by Keir Milburn and I said, oh, okay, Karl Mannheim wrote something interesting about generations. If you say it is obvious that young people are the ones always leading struggles, then I'd say, okay, so why haven't we theorized that?
Yeah, I agree.
Why is that? My position was, I was depressed when we got 2038. Then the young people came to the street and I realized that their call, the for future, as abstract as that may have sounded and as empty as that was a call that resonated. I've been working the term climate justice for 12 years, I will stand with that term, but it's a very unattractive sales pitch again. Because justice is a term that social democrats have made very boring. This is slightly different in the US, but we in Europe don't have the environmental justice tradition. So climate justice was a term that didn't really catch on. But when Fridays for Future went onto the street, I mean, there were demonstrations where you had, you know, my husband and I formed Faggots for Future. There were psychologists for Future. There were pedagogues for Future. And basically, the for Future call resonated. It was hegemoniefähig. It was capable of creating a societal hegemony, because we all remember the times when it was one of the most frequent leftist sentences was, it is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. When Fridays for Future showed up, just for a very brief moment, it became possible to imagine a future again. Because until then, capitalism seemed to have stolen not just the present, all of the futures from us. And when I realized that you could then fill this idea of a future also with other stories than just about climate, for example, I think the future is, for example, the future is much more trans. The future is more queer. Stories about a future that is attractive, that people can fight for. First, the generational basis, the material interest contained in that, and then a story that allowed people to opt in, as it were. That made them into the actor that mobilized 1.4 million people in Germany on the 20th of September, vastly dwarfing any other climate protest that had ever happened. Now, at that point, I thought, okay, this is interesting, except that then the German government, at the very same day of that demonstration, had the chutzpah to publish its Klimapaket, its climate package, climate policy package, which was a spit in the face. I was actually on the stage when that came out, and I stand next to close to some Friday's cadre, and I was looking at them thinking, okay, now they're going to have to like start calling for some form of sabotage, mass disobedience or whatever. And they didn't. And I spent the next half year calling sort of for massive disobedience, and then Corona happened. And a year later, I dropped out of the climate struggle.
Because you're disappointed in the young generation, or?
I mean, Marx was also at some point disappointed in the industrial proletariat, because the story that I told about them, like sort of that essentially they are the universal actor that's going to bring about emancipation, was just as silly and as magical realism as dialectical Marxism.
I disagree.
Of course you do, you're a trot. But basically, dialectics is actually a religious idea that something sort of creates its own negation, and then those two meet and create a synthesis. That is literally an idea that comes out of late medieval scholasticism, where they had to explain why God would create the earth. Sorry, but that's literally the origin of dialectics, is religious claptrap. And I knew that I was engaging in some kind of magical thinking. I was aware of that, and I wrote that. But the problem is that there is no other way to bridge the gap between what is possible and what is necessary than with magical thinking. In Andreas, I think, there is some magical thinking around technologies. I mean, any form of carbon capture out of the air is the only form of carbon capture out of the air that is commercially viable. It's in its use for enhanced oil recovery. That is the only commercially viable carbon capture project. So that said, for me, the magical element was provided by movements. For others, it's green hydrogen or the green economy. Like, we all need a magical element that allows us to bridge the gap between what is necessary and what is possible, because what is necessary is just not possible at this point. I cannot see a path, and that'll be my last point. Last point for now. Andreas, you said at the beginning, that means we have to fight even more. But the thing is, I don't fight to feel good about myself, nor do I fight to defend my own life. I'm fighting to defend other people's lives. And if I'm not doing that, then why should I fight? I will, of course, continue fighting. But in a way, Raymond Williams said, what is truly radical is not to make despair convincing, but hope realistic. I have lost the ability right now to make hope realistic. And the reason, Andreas, why I wanted to talk to you is because I think you currently are the one with that ability. And that's why I was so frustrated with that worker story, because I thought, no. That's completely uninspiring. Like, I've debunked those arguments 1,500 times. Yeah. Like, let's go somewhere where we can find hope again. Okay, so it's not going to be the workers who are going to lead it. What their position is, unclear. The generation is interesting, but they are largely bourgeois. And in that sense, their class interest is to maintain the status quo. Where is our source of hope beyond a sort of crass voluntarism that says, let's just all fuck shit up?
I'm in total sympathy with that feeling, and I don't pretend to have an answer to it that doesn't have that magical component that you pinpoint. But I mean, if we leave aside the sort of existential questions here and the ones about personal choices and all that, and our different, everyone's different experience with movement and all that, I'd like to go back to the question of where do we go from here, given the wave that we had in 2019 and that was so abruptly ended by the onset of the pandemic? And how shall we assess the paralysis that the climate movement has been in over the past year in the global north? Can it regain any of the momentum from 2019? Or is that now a cycle that has come to an end and there will have to be a completely different cycle? Will that mean that there will have to be another person like Greta Thunberg, something else than the Fridays for Future, a new Extinction Rebellion kind of initiative following on another kind of climate disaster? Also, I think we need to, in relation to the idea of Badiou-style events, to think a little bit about our experience that is so frustrating, I think, in recent years with those eruptions of demonstrations, activism around one topic or another that then dies down and doesn't leave a trace in any kind of political lasting dynamic. How can we plot some kind of strategy for the climate movement where one cycle feeds into the next? And can we imagine an escalation also in terms of like organizational capacities and structure so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time? What are the limits that social media imposes on activism in our time? These are some of the things that I think we should grapple with as well. And I'd like to hear what your thoughts are, Tadjo, on what should the movement do in its present state of coma? Should we just continue to stay home as long as this pandemic lasts? And what do we do once it's over? Or what? I don't know if you have thoughts on.
I have to preface this by saying that I'm a quite manic character. And when I'm up, I'm up. When I'm down, I'm kind of down. And I'm currently in a political depression. Mm. I do not, and we may have a difference on the idea of whether the climate can tip or not. I do not see that there's any path to us preventing the climate from tipping into an unstable state. And if the global climate system tips into an unstable state, we'd basically be leaving the kind of comfort zone that has allowed for the last 12,000 years of human civilization, if you want to call it that. I don't really see a realistic path towards that. So that's kind of my preface. You're sort of asking somebody who's dying of alcoholism how to stop drinking. And that was a terrible metaphor. appalling, please cut that out. Could somebody in post-production edit that? Thank you very much. One of the reasons why I miss movement so much in the corona age is because movement for us is also a sense of identity and collectivity. Mm. It's a sort of, it's a little bit our Gemeinde, our community, almost similar to a kind of church community. Movement was kind of my God. Like, movement was the actor that could make everything good. I mean, I would say, I would go to events and say, social movements are the source of all that is good, true, and beautiful in the world. And I thought they were the ones who always sort of make good stuff happen. And then we did our best and we failed to make good stuff happen. My current position is this. The cycle, last cycle is broken because cycles really also just follow, in a way, laws of physics. And if a forward momentum is completely stopped, say a wave crashes against a wall, once you take down that ball, the wave doesn't just restart. So the cycle is definitely broken. Many of the cadre like me who pushed it are licking their wounds, some are having kids, various forms of not withdrawing, but spending less time with the struggle. I believe the last climate justice movement was a sort of next iteration of the global justice movement of the 1990s. I think that the young generation, Generation Climate, as I sometimes call it, I think they have to create their own stories. I mean, they never really got down with the term climate justice so much. They used it, but they never really owned it. By the way, I distance myself from these Dark Mountain proto-fascists who, just because some of the words I might say, they might sound similar. If you don't know them, don't look them up. Sort of apocalyptic people in the global north who say, well, everybody's going to die, so we're just going to retreat to a mountain. It's like, yeah, you're going to not fucking die, you white, rich bastard. But so I do believe that the world is going to become a darker place in this century. And I think that the stories that we told in the 1990s were still kind of residues from the 1970s, where there still was a perspective for a sort of real global justice, even some kind of revolution in a positive sense. I think we may have to say goodbye to that perspective and ask ourselves, what are stories that we can tell now in a world that will get darker? I mean, this isn't the only pandemic that will happen. I mean, you know, we're all watching news and sort of the stories about how this may be the new normal. I think the news cycle will be led by a global generation, and it'll tell stories not of global revolution, but maybe of moments of empowerment or of moments of emancipation or of moments of joy. Or in my case, there'll be a lot of moments of horny and hotness. That doesn't sound very hopeful, but I kind of broke my nose not just against German coal unions, but also against the intransigence of Fridays for Future in Germany, where it was completely obvious that the next move would have been organizing massive disobedience themselves, and the leadership and the base both stood against that. There was a left wing in Fridays for Future, but it was not powerful enough. And there was this lovely quote, was it by from the Leopard? Everything, the reformist sort of adage, motto, everything must change so everything can remain the same. And that's, I think, largely what Fridays would have wanted to do. But the world will get worse, and they will therefore have to create stories that motivate people to fight, even though the big, major sort of global revolutionary utopia won't happen. It just means that I can't tell these stories because I'm an old school leftist and I need the big macro utopia.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let me just say that utopia has never been my genre or in line with my temperament. But when it comes to storytelling, I have to say that the one big resource that we have right now is a novel by a storyteller, Kim Stanley Robinson, The Ministry for the Future, that I think is the greatest book on climate politics published since Naomi Klein's big one. And the story that it tells is of a world that's getting darker. It starts with this hyper-lethal heat wave that kills about 20 million people in northern India in 2025 in the course of just a week. And after that, the dams burst and young Indians form a group called the Children of Kali and fans out across the globe in a way that we know is logistically and technically impossible and start attacking fossil fuel installations and in fact also executives and ultra-rich people. So they go beyond property destruction and start killing people. This novel is so great because it outlines a kind of best case scenario for the next decades, as Robinson himself has advertised it. But even in this best case, it's of course punctuated by these horrendous disasters, but they propel people to fight, not so much in a state of hope or with a desire to achieve some kind of utopia, but in the case of those Indians, it's even the desire for revenge, I think, that animate them to attack fossil fuel technologies and their profiteers around the world. Public Enemy had this line in the great album Apocalypse 91, The Enemy Strikes Back. It starts with, the future holds nothing else but confrontation. And I think that has never been truer than now. And that confrontation is something that our side, we progressives, can't shy away from. And when it comes to the climate, we should try to act as radically as we can without going too far and alienating people before we have those mega disasters where 20 million people are killed and things like that. Not because we think this would bring us communism. I mean, the struggle for communism will be that for survival in the coming century. And here my position is completely in line with that outlined by the Salvage Collective, which I see as the antidote to Dark Mountain, while at the same time being a representative of a kind of a revolutionary Marxism without any optimism, without any illusions about us being on the cusp of victory or anything like that. But I think stories of these kind can be told and will be told, and this novel by Robinson is a great exercise in how you can actually tell those stories. And I think there will be new phases in the struggle where new stories of that kind will emerge, and a few of them will be totally in the utopian key.
Yeah, I'm going to link to that novel for sure, guys. I wanted to talk to you or wanted to hear your opinions on the role of the state, the question of the state. We missed that so far. Compared to the climate crisis, the states are acting fast and decisive in the face of the coronavirus. You compared that response, Andreas, in one of your recent books to kind of a war communism. And there's a question right now how we could or how we should use the state in the face of the climate crisis. So that's obviously a contested question on the left as well. So maybe you both can elaborate a bit. What's your position on that?
Well, I mean, the question of the state is a complex one. And in my Corona book, when I spoke about ecological war communism and things like that, that was an argument that I made, I sketched over a week in a very crude fashion, and that needs a lot of elaboration. But generally, I just think that if there is ever going to be any transition away from fossil fuels, states will be the actors to make the necessary decisions at the end of the day. As in, I don't think, and I think this ties in with the strategy of Ende Gelände, as Tadjo outlined it earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but we don't entertain the idea that we as activists, or we in the climate movement, can on our own, by our direct actions, shut down the entire fossil fuel infrastructure and replace it with whatever alternative we want to see. Our task is to initiate a process and build mass pressure outside the state. And our wager is that at some point, the balance of forces will be sufficiently on our side to set in process some kind of a transition. Now, there might very well be a magic component to that. But the political point here to me is that we cannot have that kind of anarchist hyper-confidence in our own abilities as activists to execute everything that is necessary. By the way, I wanted to say another thing on something that Tadjo said, and it's on how the climate system works. Well, I don't see it as having one specific threshold or tipping point that we're nearing, and once we've crossed that, we're doomed to spiraling chaos and there's no point in action any longer. I think the climate system has several different tipping points, and for everyone that is crossed, the situation gets worse. but it's not like we're in a mode of climate stability and then it flips over into hothouse Earth and we're doomed to Venus or something like that. There are intermediate stages in that process. And for every line that is crossed, it becomes more urgent not to cross the next one and so on and so forth. State action, if it ever starts, will be the vector through which change ultimately happens, because you can't accomplish something like a 10% emissions reduction year on year in Germany or Sweden or in the US by any other actor than the state leading that process. Clearly, now the problem is that our states are not doing this. They're not going to do it of their own volition, of their own accord, on their own initiative. They will have to be pushed into doing it. Of course, someone could argue an objection to my line of argument here, that if we were ever to get as strong as this would require, we would be able to sort of remote control the state to do our bidding, then we could just as well take over the state or reconstitute ourselves as the state. And I would be open for that too, but it's a distant prospect.
So, first of all, the point about the climate system tipping. Now, I am by no means a scientist of any sort, really. Even as a political scientist, I kind of sucked. But as far as I understand, the global climate system is a complex system. Complex systems have two kinds of states, stable and unstable. And once they tip out of unstable states, they can stay for a very long time in unstable states in which we do not know what happens. So I believe that you're right, Andreas, talking about these specific tipping points within the Earth system. But the global climate system as a whole is a system with two kinds of states that are going to have stable or unstable. And it's been in a stable state for 12,000 years. And in the so-called Holocene, ooh, we're going to get to the Anthropocene versus Capitalocene debate. But basically, there are individual tipping points, but the last 12,000 years of human civilization have all taken place within a period of unusual climatic stability, the Holocene, where the average mean temperature doesn't diverge more than 2 degrees from the norm. And if that space is left, in fact, that's actually a global unitary phenomenon, not the weather changes, but whether there's stable or unstable climate in the world, because the global climate system is an interconnected system. So I do not have the references to now have this debate with you, Andreas. It just seems we have different positions here. Mm-hmm. But we probably both have a sort of sense of urgency, and that's where the question of the state comes in. I think actually that this idea that there are kind of anarchists who want to do everything in their small scale backyards is more prevalent in Sweden, where anarchism, I lived in Sweden for a while, anarchism is more prevalent there. There's actually a politically relevant anarchist union, SAC, and unlike Germany's FAU, which is three people.
It's quite politically irrelevant here too, I have to say, but I'm happy that that this is your diagnosis, that I'm hopeful that you're right. That
but basically, it seems to me that sort of, you're triggering people in their identitarian reflexes. Like, the way I always do it is, all right, can your collective produce my HIV medicine? No? All right, so unless you can produce my HIV medicine in your backyard, of the backyard of your collective, we need to scale up solutions. I think of it, I do think when you say I'm against sort of anarchist small-scale thing, just leave out the term anarchist and say, like, the idea that you can have these small-scale, non-state-based solutions is sort of absurd, and I'm not even going to spend time on it. I see that there was a lockdown of parts of the economy, which was politically driven. And by politically driven, I, of course, dissolve the question of the state, as it were, or ignore it. So I don't have to deal with the old state theory questions. Can the state do stuff against capital? Rah, rah, rah. But a politically driven lockdown that, at least ideologically in some countries, was justified with the solidaristic, solidarisch, sort of argument. Both German and Swedish have an adjective for solidarity. English does not, which must be the result of weaker workers' movement. A bit of Marxist monism here. And basically, that is a place I would like to start thinking about. So the two things I'd like to put together are the possibility for large-scale generational mobilization, base, with a strategy that aims at the state as the agent that, even as the ideal general capitalist, if that's what it's called in English, the ideal Gesamtkapitalist, could shut down other capitals in the ideal general interest of capital.
You're absolutely right. And I don't think that it's inconceivable that it could happen when climate disasters reach the level of intensity that the pandemic had, or was at least perceived to have. The measures that that states took early on in the pandemic, and I agree with you that they cut emissions, they did it even steeper than what we've argued for in the first months. Then there was a rebound, of course. But I mean, these measures were put in place by states without any social movements in any way prompting the states to do so. It would probably need to be different under conditions of climate disaster. But the danger, of course, is that when the crisis becomes as intense as the pandemic was perceived to be a year ago, the risk, I think, is that states jump for something completely different, and that is solar geoengineering, because that is the kind of measure that works similarly to lockdowns or vaccines, that you can have an immediate effect, or so it would seem. And you don't need to tinker with business as usual, and you don't need to challenge any property classes or dominant class interests or anything. So that's something that I think we need to prepare for much more in the climate movement, that is an actual risk that states can jump on that, some state or another. Yeah, some agent jump on that as a pseudo solution. And what do we do then?
At this point, I probably have to say that I've been discussing questions of climate strategy for 13 years now, 14. I started thinking about this climate stuff in 2007 around the Heiligen Damm G8 summit, because Angela Merkel started talking about it and positioned the G8 as a non-neoliberal institution, which may or may not have been the case. But essentially, I'm so tired, because basically after we lost against the coal industry, we started planning the next fight against the car industry. And there's some amazing comrades working on that here. Sometimes they call me and say, hey, do you want to like talk to us about this? And I'm like, I co-authored the strategy that lost against coal. Coal is only a fraction of the power of cars in Germany. How do we challenge that at this point? I don't know. And this is where we come to the fact where I'm incredibly tired and kind of, and if I start crying now, it's because I'm a generally emotional person. But I feel so beaten and battered and wounded and traumatized. And like, I mean, the trade unions, by the way, one of the reasons why I can't stand them is because they contributed to me being essentially bullied out of my job. But that's just a sort of personal point. For just a moment, I don't know. I want to have the luxury of saying, and I know that's a luxury and a privilege, I don't know the answers to those questions, because I spent 14 years thinking about them and writing about them and traveling around the world and fighting and getting my ass kicked and sometimes, you know, briefly winning, as with Endingland. I need a break. I'm currently sort of going through a whole bunch of really interesting, powerful and beautiful. I am freshly in love with this amazing sort of BDSM-driven love and BDSM-driven transformation. And my head is on those questions.
That's fine, Tadjo. And you deserve your break more than anyone else. And it's perfectly fine to have a break, even in this struggle. Mm-hmm. I just hope that we can get you back, because I assume that Ende Gelände and other German climate movements will need your capacities. But let that be in 5 years into the future, or 10 or 15 or however long you need. The struggle will be on for then, by then as well. And I, who sit in Sweden and am not an organizer and haven't been in many years, I mean, it's part of my privileged position to continue to write and discuss about those things. I haven't paid the price of an activist banging my head against the wall of trade union bureaucracies and making other kinds of personal sacrifices the way that you have in recent years. So I'm not going to try to convince you to stop with what you like to do and get back to exactly what you've been doing for 13 years. I hope there are other comrades who can take over. And the quality of the Ende Gelände caterers to me seems to suggest that there are indeed quite a few comrades that can, I don't know if they can step into your shoes, but they probably can continue to do some great work. And my magical hope is that with coming events, coming climate impacts, you will see more people, not fewer, plunging themselves into desperate climate activism. That's the only thing I can hope for.
Yeah, I'm going to sort of try and sort of say a concluding statement that doesn't just mean, oh, I'm going to go off having sex, so never mind the rest of the world. global injustices will multiply. And if we do not fight against them, the global north, we are the worst kinds. We are the kind of white liberals that Martin Luther King hated, who said that his problem isn't so much the sort of hardcore racist, but the white liberal who doesn't realize that his position in life is connected to what that white racist does. So I'm not saying stop fighting. I'm saying we have to adjust the way we think the fight to the possibility of none of it winning in the way we imagine it. And we have to write new codes, stories, and songs. And I meant this in the metaphorical sense. I'm not sure I like most activist songs, but for a world that's going to get darker. We've sort of been at that point before, but one that's not the Dark Mountain story to retreat. And so I haven't read The Salvage Collective for a while, but maybe there's some stories in there. But there are amazing young cadre. And in a way, I'm also just stepping back from a movement where I'm incredibly, I'm going to start crying, where I'm incredibly proud to have contributed to the creation of something like Endegelände and to have inspired all these people. And now I just need to take a break and light a joint because I'm bleeding. And if I look back at the battlefield, I get scared and I just need to be away for a while.
That's perfectly fine. And I hope that, you'll be back at some point. And in the meantime, other people will step forth.
I know. And those will mostly be, they will be younger, more female, and less pale than you,
my Andreas. Inshallah. That's absolutely central. Absolutely.
Some good final words, Tatio and Andreas. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Lucas, for organizing this. Thank you, Andreas. Yeah. Much love.
Thank you, Tatio. Much love from here.
Okay, everybody, this was the Malm-Müller debate on the Dissens podcast. Thank you so much for joining us here. And if you want to know more about Dissens or my work, and if you want to support my work, which you can do, then have a look in the show notes or go to my website, dissenspodcast.de. There you find all the information and every possible way to support my work here. Again, thank you for tuning in, and we hear each other next week with a new episode of Dissens.